Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, we take a look at new content from the Center for Literary Publishing and invite editors and authors to read and discuss the work coming out of the center. My name is Megan Pipe, and today Kylan Rice will join me and Lauren Matheny as he hands the podcast reins over to us. We'll dive into the archives to read Barrington Smith Sitacit's Superman Falling from the fall-winter 2008 issue of Colorado Review. Afterward, Barrington will join Lauren over Skype to chat about the story. Stay tuned.
So, Lauren and Megan, thanks for joining me today. It's nice to be with you in our studio this afternoon.
Nice to be here.
Ditto.
So, Lauren and Megan are being groomed for the producer position here for the Colorado Review podcast. We've got a great story that we're going to be reading, actually from an older issue. Megan, you want to tell us what issue this is from and the title and the author's name?
Sure. So Superman Falling by Barrington Smith Sitacit is from the fall-winter 2008 issue of Colorado Review.
Great. Yeah. And we don't get a lot of opportunities to dive back in the archive, but maybe that'll change. Who knows? I'm just curious, now, Megan, you were kind of the one who spearheaded picking this. Tell me what caught your eye about Superman Falling initially.
For me, it was the introduction of a really familiar, really dumb joke that I think most of us have heard. And so for the story to begin in that way, but then really make surprising and make dramatic what I had always thought of as just a stupid throwaway joke was surprising and interesting. And I think that the way that it dives into character from that point really caught my attention as a reader.
So this is a story of aftermath. I wonder, you know, you both write fiction, and I'm curious if you might talk a little bit about, I feel like this is kind of a genre, you know, like in a way, like loosely the genre of what happened next, you know, what happened after a traumatic event. And we won't necessarily spoil the traumatic event right now, but I'm just curious if you could meditate maybe broadly on, I mean, what do you get out of a story that works this way, that begins once the action has ended, so to speak?
Well, I was particularly interested in the way this story delivers information about that traumatic event because, you know, there are versions of the loss story. You're talking about the genre where everything's front-loaded. We understand what happened right away. And this story is not written like that. As Megan said, it starts with a joke. We really have no idea where we're headed. And then throughout the story, we're parceled little bits of information of what has led the characters to be here. And I found that really fascinating. And I think it changes what could be not just a story of loss, but a story of loss into something more, as Megan said, into character, really getting in deep into these characters, the way they've been changed by this. Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, the way you're talking about, like, delivery of information, the reader learns about events that have happened in the past at a completely different, on a completely different timeline than the character is aware of. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of an interesting kind of trajectory. If in any good story featuring a character, there's some kind of character progression, then we begin in a way with a character who has already achieved some state of, like, progression after an event, but our development happens at kind of a different trajectory. I just think that that's kind of an interesting sort of kind of a working against the grain, you know, we work against the grain kind of the character themselves in a way.
Yeah, so. Yeah, definitely. And I think too that withholding of information that the character knows when we enter the story, but we as readers don't learn it until later, seemed to speak to this like repression of past actions, past regrets, things that Alex, as our main character, really does not want to confront. And so the fact that we don't learn specific aspects of the secrets he's been holding until later in the story seems to speak to that, I think.
I love that idea. This is great. This is a revelation to me. Like, the idea that, like, character repression can be kind of, like, become formal on the page.
Yeah. Right.
That's great. One other thing I wanted to talk about is setting. Because we, if I'm counting right, we have essentially two, like, primary settings, right? We've got the scene where the joke is told at the beginning, which is a bar, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got, like, a fair, like, kind of an Oktoberfest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Later on. So, like, two drinking scenes, right? Like,
uh-huh.
Most of this story, somebody's drinking something. Like, I'm wondering what you guys make of that, the kind of settings that Barrington has chosen for us.
I think it's a really interesting opportunity to play on the social and the private with the way this is written, because the story of loss is just inherently private. Something so just deeply embedded into the characters, are two sort of main working characters in some ways. And yet they're forced into these social atmospheres, like you said, the bar and then Oktoberfest, with, for Alex, our protagonist, people that he does not know particularly well. And so just the way that those things contrast and butt up against each other, I think, I didn't really think about the fact that they were both drinking scenes until you said that, but now that I'm thinking about it, it provides sort of a battleground for the private and the public mm-hmm. to, like, work together,
mm-hmm.
which is very cool.
Yeah.
Well, great. Let's hear Megan Pipe reading Superman Falling.
Superman Falling by Barrington Smith Sitachit.
Alex is drinking $2 pitchers of Budweiser at Zonka's Bar in Ryan, Indiana, with some guys who went to high school with his wife 15 years ago. Most of them outweigh Alex by about 50 pounds, and most seem to be named Matt or Dave. One of the Matts is telling a joke about two guys at a rooftop bar in New York City. About a minute later, the guy who jumped floats back up to the roof. The other guy can't believe it. He's like, "How the hell did you do that?" The first guy says, "Well, the wind against the building makes such a strong updraft that it lifts you." Alex angles himself to see his wife, Sarah, across the room, hoping she might come over, but she's playing darts with a group of women. They're talking, occasionally singing to the piped-in 80s music. This mini-reunion, consisting of tonight's meet-and-greet, tomorrow's 80s costume disco, and a bring-the-family picnic on Sunday, has been organized locally. Most of the attendees live in Ryan or the towns surrounding it. A few have driven from Indianapolis. One couple has come from Chicago, but still roots for the Colts. Sarah and Alex are the only ones to come from as far as New York. Sarah had been unable to travel during her pregnancy 5 years ago and missed the larger 10-year high school reunion, so she has made this trip to visit old friends and the town where she grew up. Alex has come for reasons less clear, even to himself. Earlier in their 8-year marriage, he'd found reasons not to come to the Midwest, usually citing an upcoming deadline for an advertising campaign or a creative meeting he could not afford to miss. This time, Sarah hadn't urged him at all, saying, "I can go. You don't need to bother." It was her lack of heat toward him that made him catch his breath. At the agency, Alex has a good instinct for knowing when a client is perhaps thinking about going another way. He is reputed to have a flair for bringing disgruntled customers back into the fold, moving them from the back burner to the front until the crisis has passed. Occasionally, though, if an account rep has been neglectful for too long or the markup has been too obvious, sometimes such efforts come too late. But that's not the case with Sarah, he tells himself. He can turn this one around. "But I want to spend time with you," he'd told her. "Fine, but I'm planning to have a nice time, so if you're going to naysay or act bored, you should just stay home." He'd assured her that he really wanted to come. It would be fun. Alex turns back to his table, trying to look as if he could be having fun. The second guy's like, "That's amazing! I've got to try it!" So he jumps over the side of the building. Alex notices Matt has started slurring his words after only 3 beers, surprising for a big guy. One of the Daves seems nervous. He interrupts the joke. "Hey, Matt, is this your round?" Yeah, says Matt. "In a minute." So nothing happens. He doesn't come back up. People look over the edge, and it's not a pretty sight. The bartender looks at the first guy and says, "Superman, I gotta say, when you drink, you can be a real asshole." Some of the guys laugh, confused by those who are silent, red-faced. Alex sets his glass down carefully. The men who are laughing don't know about Rory, Alex and Sarah's three-year-old son, who died last year in a fall from their sixth-floor balcony. The other men, who are suddenly quiet, either hadn't realized where the joke was headed or hadn't been able to stop it. Now it's a social clusterfuck. The Matt who told the joke is still talking, unaware. Alex wants to hit him. Instead, he leans across the table. "Ever been to New York?" he asks this Matt. "Can't say I have. Nikki, my wife, went up there once with some girlfriends. They went to see one of those Broadway shows." "What about a rooftop bar?" Alex articulates deliberately. "Ever been to one of those? Maybe in Chicago or Toronto. How about Los Angeles?" "Is there a problem?" Matt looks at Alex, confused and pissed. The Dave who had tried to interrupt the joke takes Matt by the arm, saying, "Walk to the bar with me." Matt looks back at Alex as he walks away. Alex would be the asshole, except his son died. This buys him a lot of leeway. Another Matt tries to smooth things over. "Looks like you've been taking good care of Sally." Sally is what Sarah is called by her childhood friends, though none of them seem to know why. She is at the bar now. She looks good, in her jeans and a wraparound top, her reddish hair down on her shoulders instead of pulled up. She's perched on a stool, talking to a guy who's got 6 inches and another 100 pounds on anyone here. His name is not Matt or Dave, but Dan. Everybody, however, calls him Tiny, which she appears to enjoy being called. Alex prefers to call him Dan. Dan's got his plaid flannel shirt open, over his t-shirt. He and Sarah look real cozy. They've known each other since grade school, and though they never officially dated, she went to 2 proms with him just as friends, and after the second one, she had sex with him in the back seat of someone's car. She can't remember whose. Outside of a party, she can't remember whose. Afterward, she and Dan went back inside to the party, and they've never really talked about it since. Every so often, when Alex and Sarah get a baby announcement or a Christmas card from Dan and his wife, Christine, Alex can't help bringing up that night, and Sarah says she's sorry she ever mentioned it. She says that after 20 years, that night is the least indicative of what her and Dan's friendship is about. Looking at them now, Dan's head bent to bring his ear to Sarah's mouth, Alex is pretty sure that's exactly the night Dan thinks about when he signs their Christmas card each year. Alex is ready to leave, but he doesn't want to go without Sarah, and he doesn't want to be the one to pull her away, so he nods and smiles through a few more beers, careful not to let her see him watching her. There is a tension between them lately, like a rubber band that sometimes feels pulled tight to the point of snapping. She says he has become too protective, that she can't stand his hovering. She accuses him of calling her too often at the graphics company where she's returned to work, pretending he's forgotten what item she'd wanted at the store, or what time they have reservations at a restaurant. Finally, after a series of hugs and shaking hands, they head back to the Holiday Inn. Dan and Christine had offered their guest room. Alex had not said that the last thing he wanted was to wake up and make pancakes with Dan and Christine and their 2 kids still in their jammies, all calling Sarah Sally, and acting like they somehow know her better than he does. He had just said that he felt uncomfortable imposing, and Sarah hadn't argued. Walking to the motel, Alex and Sarah are both pleasantly drunk, and the rubber band between them feels looser than it has for a long time. Sarah walks along the curb and wiggles her butt, singing under her breath, don't you want me? Then stops suddenly. Damn it, she says, looking mournfully at an empty lot on the corner. They tore down the Waffle House. Alex has never seen the Waffle House, though he knows that Sarah and her friends used to squeeze into its booths late at night when they were too young for bars and everything else was closed. She wanders into the street. You know I can't believe it when you say that you don't need me. The road is empty, the town is small, but Alex can't shake the thought that a drunk driver could come around the corner at any moment. He takes Sarah's hand. She twirls under his arm, happy, until she realizes he's just trying to pull her back onto the sidewalk. She yanks her hand away from his and walks ahead, silent, in the street. When they get to their room, she lies facing away from him on the bed. In the darkness, even after her breathing grows heavy, he envisions the rubber band stretching tighter. The next day, Alex and Sarah drive their rental car to the covered bridge festival, traversing back roads behind Dan and Christine's truck and an endless caravan of cars driving at a pace normally reserved for people looking for parking or passing a five-car pileup. Alex listens as Sarah enthusiastically describes the cornucopia of artery-clogging foods, crocheted handicrafts, and paintings of fall leaves that await them. In the cars in front of and behind them, people are taking pictures of the covered bridges, which look like barns with double doorways spanning five-foot creek beds. Every few miles, they pass a cluster of houses whose owners have seen the extra traffic as an opportunity to put their unwanted belongings on tables next to signs that say yard sale. The first time Dan and Christine stop, Sarah says, "Why not? It's part of the experience." Alex pretends to study a handful of water-stained LPs as Sarah helps Christine dig through piles of children's clothing. Only a month ago, Sarah had burst into tears as they walked past the Gap Kids on 86th and 3rd. Now she is talking and laughing as she holds up items for Dan's opinion. Back in the car, Alex almost asks her what has changed, but Dan and Christine are already pulling over again. This time, Alex stays in the car. After several minutes, Sarah approaches the driver's side window. "You should go ahead to the festival with Dan. Christine and I will catch up." Her tone is neutral, but in it lives a history of similar phrases spoken in similar instances in which Alex failed to show the proper interest or enthusiasm. At a party, "Why don't you go on home? I can take a cab." On a Saturday morning, "Maybe you should just call a friend and go out for coffee. I think I'll take Rory out today." He can recognize when he has failed and been dismissed. "This is good," says Dan when Alex gets in the truck. "We can get a head start on the beers. They've decided to combine with Oktoberfest, so there's German beer hall. At night when it gets cooler, they play some polkas and stuff, which isn't too bad when you're hammered." "Sounds great," Alex says. Sarah has impressed upon Alex that Dan's a nice guy, that he's not stupid. Apparently, he got a full ride to some private engineering school and could have gotten a job anywhere if he hadn't been so emotionally stuck in the sticks that he dropped out. Eventually, he graduated from one of the state schools, and now he counsels delinquent teens. Alex isn't sucked in by his big guy with a big heart routine, but since everyone else seems to be, he's determined to play along. Alex notices the back seat of the truck is lined three across with child seats. Carly, Daphne, and Jonah are at their grandmother's for the day. Dan catches him looking. Carly's still in a booster seat till she's 8. "Hard to believe we used to just tumble around in the back." "Yeah. They'll be at the picnic tomorrow." Dan's tone indicates he doesn't know if this is something Alex will appreciate. Since Rory's death, when he's with other parents, Alex sometimes feels like a guy who's lost all his money but still comes to the party. People don't know whether to try to share their wealth or apologize for it. "Great." Dan turns up the radio. Alex looks out the window, sneaking looks at the car seats through the rearview mirror. If Rory were back there, he would want to play his REM tape the whole way. Rory loved REM. He could bounce in his seat and listen to it for hours. Though it got a little old sometimes, Alex was always happy he chose Life's Rich Pageant instead of later albums. The kid had taste. Alex just hadn't realized it at first. When Rory was born with Down syndrome, Alex had been so busy mourning his former idea of the future, as they gave up Rory's spot on the Montessori waiting list and put away books on raising the gifted child, that he could barely look at his son. On the day Sarah dressed Rory in the onesie with Alex's alma mater, Vassar, printed across the chest, he wanted to put a fist through the wall. When Alex and Dan get to the festival, kids are running everywhere, mouths stained snow cone blue, chewing on pieces of fried dough bigger than their heads. There are buildings with handicrafts and a mechanical bull in the center of a red and blue inflatable ring. Each time a rider gets on the bull, the operator jams a cowboy hat on his head, and friends and families take pictures. The guy who controls the bull keeps it slow for the kids and grandmas, goes faster and harder for the men and teenagers wearing muscle shirts and baseball caps. The beer garden is in a large tent with long tables and a stage at one end. Their waitress, dressed as a German beer maid, has a shaggy blonde bob and thick hipster glasses. She looks a little like Claire, an assistant at Alex's office, with whom he'd had an affair. The affair is something he's never told Sarah about. It took place in the first months after Rory's diagnosis. At the time, Alex had felt the only conversations he had with his wife consisted of Sarah relaying information from the specialist or the nutritionist, or telling him what her new friends on the Down Syndrome internet forum had to say about the advice from the specialist or the nutritionist. Somehow, he'd equated her adaptability with a kind of simple-minded acceptance. He'd wanted to distance himself from that, from the support groups and the books on the nightstand with names like Sometimes Miracles Hide. He'd started staying at work later, and Claire had been sympathetic and available. To tell Sarah now would only hurt her unnecessarily, he figures, so the best thing he can do is keep his mouth shut. The beer maid serves them steins of a very passable locally brewed beer, dark and strong. They anchor it down with a couple of brats.
Not bad, huh? Says Dan.
Yeah, pretty good. We're real glad you and Sally could make it down. So are we, Alex says, thinking of how they could have driven to the Catskills or flown to the Keys. After a while, Dan signals for another round and dives into his third bratwurst. They've exhausted sports and favorite episodes of Iron Chef as topics of conversation. Alex has one eye on the entrance to the tent, where figures pass in silhouette against the bright sun outside. He wonders whether Sarah and Christine will call when they arrive, or just wander around until they find them. A couple of sticky-faced kids run in, dart under one end of the long table where Alex and Dan are sitting, and scramble over their feet. The men watch as the kids emerge at the other end, just missing a collision with the beer maid as she brings their order. "Do you think about trying again?" Dan asks. It still surprises Alex when people ask things like this, things that are none of their business. "It's out there. I guess it's still a little soon," Alex says. He's tried broaching the subject with Sarah, tried bringing up the options. When he does, she nods and says, "That's a possibility," in a way that closes the discussion. Before Rory, there had been thermometers, ovulation tests, pamphlets on adoption. They still have the pamphlets, but no one has dialed the numbers printed on them. No one has scheduled any trips to China. "We've got stuff going on," Alex finds himself adding, "with a lawsuit and all that." Alex and Sarah, along with their condominium association, are suing the contractors who incorrectly installed the metal grill around their balcony. "How's that going?" Dan asks, and takes a drink of his beer. "We're pretty certain to win it. They've made an offer, even. I think Sarah would just take it, but it's unconscionable to me that they want to bargain. The full amount is... I don't know. It says something."
"So the amount matters?"
"Yeah, I think so. It's like the money is the measure, you know?"
"What do you feel like it measures?"
Dan doesn't move when the beer maid picks up empties and sets down a couple more. He just waits for Alex to continue.
"I don't know. The degree of fault, I guess. I mean, it's their fault, but it shows everyone. Who's to blame, I guess?"
"Do you feel like people blame you?"
Dan's voice is so neutral, so non-judgmental. Alex has opened his mouth to answer when it dawns on him. Dan's trying to counsel him, like one of his juvies. Alex slams his mug down and some beer sloshes onto his hand.
"What do you think you're doing?"
"We're just talking. I just thought you might want to talk about it."
"I don't. Fuck." His face feels numb. He pushes himself to standing. "I'm going to take a piss."
Alex is nearly at the front of the line for the portable toilet when he remembers Sarah's lips at Dan's ear the night before. When he's done peeing, he finds Dan waiting in front of the beer tent.
"What did she say to you?"
Alex can hear himself talking too loud, almost shouting in Dan's face. Dan pushes Alex back, but gently, hands around his shoulders as if holding him up.
"She just said that you'd refuse to go to counseling. She thought it might help if you talked to someone."
"Someone like you?" He tries to control his voice, deliver the right amount of sneering disbelief. He wants Dan to take the first swing. Dan just nods. He's like the silhouette of a mountain, blocking the glaring sun. Alex wants to knock it down. You play it really well, don't you? You think if you're Mr. Understanding, maybe you'll get some again? Alex thinks he sees Dan flinch. Hey, maybe she'll leave me, come back here, and live down the street from you. Actually, Dan's voice mirrors Alex's mocking tone. She said she was looking at houses in Indy. There's a silence now. Alex knows Dan's words are true, by their anger and quickness, and by the expression on Dan's face as soon as they have left his mouth, as if he already wishes he could retract them. The tightness in Alex's throat suddenly expands and drops like a boulder to his stomach. He paces the little area next to the beer tent, blinking fast and trying to breathe. He doesn't know what to do with his body. He doesn't know what to do. He turns back to Dan. Did she say she's leaving me? Did she say it? No, she didn't say it, he says. You're pretty wound up. Can you calm down a little? Alex makes an effort. He takes a slow breath. She says you're overprotective and uncommunicative, and whatever you've got going on, you're keeping it to yourself, which leaves her alone. And if you're both just going to be alone, then she can't think of any good reasons to stay together. That's what she says. Alex nods. She'd said the same thing, once, during the first year of Rory's life. He'd thought it was just something she said, that she would probably keep saying it until it got tiresome. Then one Friday after work, she'd met him at the door, put Rory in his arms, and said, "Okay, here's your chance." She'd picked up her suitcase and left. She didn't return his calls for a week, until she appeared the following Friday and asked, "So do you want to stay or go?" He had stayed, of course. It had all worked out. But he has never known, had it not been for their son, if she would have come back. "But I don't know what she wants from me," he says to Dan, his voice desperate and whiny, even to himself. Dan's phone rings. "Whatever it is, you might as well just give it up." Dan raises his eyebrows and shrugs, his hands palms up like Alex should put something in them. Dan reaches for the phone, finished with the conversation now. "This'll be Christine." The four of them meet by the stand with the fried elephant ears. Sarah is in high spirits. Melted butter and sugar smears on his cheek as she kisses him lightly, demanding, "Buy me pumpkin ice cream." He marvels that they can seem so together on the surface as everything is crumbling underneath. He wants to pull her away from Dan and Christine and all of this to convince her that they are not each alone. But what he told Dan is the truth. He doesn't know where to start. Doesn't have any words to say that could fix the things that are wrong. If he tries now, she will blame him for interrupting this day with her friends. Instead, when he gets to the front of the line, he buys ice cream for everyone and makes himself eat some. He smiles and nods at the right times as they walk around. Inside the dimness of the wooden buildings, it's cooler than outside. They drift from table to table, from photographs to paintings to handmade rocking horses and leather keychains. Sarah pauses to look at wooden plaques with drawings of puppies or bouquets of flowers shellacked to them. When Alex offers to buy her one, she laughs, as if he has made a joke. Looking again at the plaques, he sees they are ugly and old-fashioned, so he plays along. He pretends he is sarcastic and witty, and all the things he felt like when they had first started dating. They emerge from the long building into fading light. Dan says, "Well, I guess we've done it all, unless anyone had their heart set on a bull ride." Alex hears himself reply, "Oh, right, I almost forgot." He is pleased by Sarah's surprised look, pleased to know when they arrive at the inflatable ring and he sees the sign stating the maximum weight is 250 pounds, that Dan will not be following his lead. He moves to the front, hand in the air. There are no reins, just the hand grip at the front of the saddle. He takes hold and waits as the operator puts the cowboy hat on his head and a camera flashes. The beer maid walks by with another woman, holding burgers and sodas. The operator pulls the lever and the bull starts moving slowly, arrhythmically. He'd ended the affair with Claire the week Sarah had left, but she called sometimes, maybe every couple months, just to be friendly. On the day that Rory died, Claire had called. She'd asked about things, about Rory, That was all. That's why Alex had gone into the kitchen, because he couldn't hear over Michael Stipp's voice singing, I am Superman, and I can do anything. And the way Rory was banging his Tonka truck, the green one Sarah's brother had had when he was a kid, against everything, the walls, the couch legs, the coffee table. The bull undulates underneath him, rotating at the same time. Alex allows his back to bend and flex and squeezes his thighs as tight as he can. It's going faster now, and he's sliding off the sides, but he keeps hanging on, pulling himself back upright. He's not thinking about the audience or whether it will hurt if he falls. He's just hanging on because he doesn't know what else to do. And then it's over. His legs shaking underneath him, he walks with the group to the parking lot. Dan and Christine have headed to their truck when Sarah looks at him. Are you all right? She asks. Alex nods yes. Then he's walking around the car, and then he's throwing up. His stomach heaves. Beer and bratwurst and pumpkin ice cream hit the dirt. He knows he's going to tell her. Sarah's hand pats his back, the way it won't in a minute or two, when he begins talking, when everything he can't keep down anymore spews out of him hot and rotten. How he heard it, a kind of chink instead of a thump, and how he didn't think because it was too unthinkable, because they had ordered the 25-millimeter square steel bars with the small gaps bolted to the brick, with child-safe netting besides. How he didn't think because there was no way, but still he'd said, "Clear, I've got to go check on Rory." And somehow, walking down the hall, before he could see it, he had known and started running. Once he begins, he cannot stop. He tells Sarah how when he saw their son, arm out over the edge, reaching for the little green truck that was already sailing through the air, he dove, he lunged, how he had been so close that he had touched him, how Alex's middle finger had grazed Rory's little heel as he went over. How if he had gotten there only 2 seconds earlier, he could have used his thumb and would have caught the boy by the heel. He would have pulled Rory to safety, and their son would have been invincible like Achilles. But because he was too late, because he could only touch the boy with the tip of his finger, it had felt like he pushed their child. And he hadn't heard because he was on the phone. He was holding the phone. He was holding another woman on the phone. He hadn't run fast enough. He had pushed their baby boy. He is so, so sorry. Afterward, in the hot car, he is sobbing and sniveling as she searches her purse for a Kleenex and hands it to him. She drives them back, past the covered bridges and the residue from yard sales. He sporadically cries and repeats short phrases, "I swear it was over," and "I'm so sorry." The tears and apologies involuntary, like aftershocks. Sarah pulls up to the Holiday Inn and stops without saying a word. He apologizes once more as he gets out. She drives away without looking at him. Alex goes into their room and sits on the edge of the bed in the path of the blasting air conditioner and cries more. Then he uses the rest of his strength to crawl under the blanket and sleeps. When he wakes, it is morning. He is alone in the bed. She has not returned. He closes his eyes and thinks about that Friday she left him. He'd watched from the window as her cab drove away and everything had pulled into focus. He'd known that even as messed up as this life was, if it was the one she was in, it was the one he wanted. During the week she was gone, he'd had to use sick days until he could find a sitter, had to figure out about diapers and baths. When Rory cried, Alex didn't know what else to do. He carried Rory outside and walked up and down the block. He met the neighbors that Sarah had mentioned, but he had never seen. They all knew Rory and seemed happy to see him. They all seemed to think Alex was happy to be with him, and after a while, he discovered that he was. Alex hadn't fallen in love with his son overnight, but in that week it had begun, and in his memory now the 2 years that followed were golden. He'd come home at the end of his days to see Rory. He'd hold him while Sarah told him everything they'd done. He and Sarah had found each other again, had rediscovered their marriage. The anger and disappointment he'd carried, that he'd been unable to imagine living without, had miraculously faded. He holds this in his mind now, as he sits up gingerly. His body is like a shell emptied out, fragile but lighter. Their flight is scheduled for this afternoon, after the picnic, so he packs up their things and checks out of the hotel. The park is large, with a road winding through it, and he has the cab drive until he spots their rental car. Sarah has left it unlocked, so he puts their suitcases inside, as if he knows the plan, and walks to the center of the empty road. He feels the blacktop beneath his feet as he turns to see expanses of green grass in every direction. Finally, he recognizes some of the parents sitting on colorful blankets, their kids running around them. And then he sees Sarah. She is holding Dan and Christine's little girl by the arms, spinning her in a circle. The girl's feet lift off the ground, and for a few rotations of the earth, she is flying.
That was Megan Pipe reading Superman Falling by Barrington Smith's Satachet. Thanks so much, Megan.
Thank you. Hi, we're back with Barrington Smith Satachet, and we are having a little question and answer session today about Superman Falling. Thank you so much for joining us, Barrington.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Great. So I guess the first thing that really drew me to this story was the perspective, because it's being told third person present tense for the most part. So we're getting a view into the peripheral characters' minds, you know, but mostly we're placed in Alex's worldview as he's balancing this situation. So I just wanted to know sort of the process of how you chose point of view. Did it just sort of spring forth naturally? Did it take some time?
Yeah, you know, somebody asked me this not that long ago, and my instinctive response was that, yeah, it had always been this kind of close third where we're, you know, with Alex, but using our third person perspective. But then I actually went back and I haven't saved all my drafts because that would take my entire computer, I think. but I did have some really early drafts and they were in first person.
Oh wow.
Which I completely had not remembered at all. And it was interesting to kind of look at it because, you know, first person, it's always a little voicier. But it's also clunkier. And I kind of now look back and I imagine at the time I was really feeling my way through things. In retrospect, I look and I'm like, oh, I see the advantages of the choice. But I imagine that I usually have to work my way through because first person seems like it could be easier. But it's more constricting in terms of what you can do and still have the read feel natural.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of started to look at that. And so with a close third, which is, you know, what we have here, you can kind of see into Alex's head, but it's like if the camera's in his head, you can also pull back and kind of do this looser third. And then you can sneak in some stuff that is kind of more authorial in tone. And I think it's like when you get, because so much of this is in the past tense and it comes, you know, like it's this exposition that you need to understand what's happening in the story, but it's not pushing the story forward.
Right.
And I think that that's where the third kind of feels less like a blunt instrument. I was looking at this one line, I just kind of picked one, and it's kind of the first time we slip into this a little bit. Her tone is neutral, but in it lives a history of similar phrases spoken in similar instances, where Alex failed to show the proper interest or enthusiasm. And I'm like, okay, that's pretty efficient. It's something that Alex knows, but it's maybe not exactly how Alex would put it. Like if you had it in first person, how would you deal with that? And then I was like, how would I deal with that? Because I don't think I ever had to. And I was like, her tone sounds neutral, but I mean, you have to understand there's this whole history in it that I can hear. She said the same kinds of things in a lot of other situations over the years, like when I don't seem enthusiastic enough about being at some party or et cetera, et cetera. It's just like it's a big tonal shift.
Right.
So it kind of works, but it takes longer. It's a little less efficient. So I think I probably stumbled onto it But then, you know, looking at it, I'm like, oh, I'm glad I did.
In this story, you're utilizing the third person to actually sort of parcel out the information in a really fascinating way. So even though we're third person, we're sort of getting narration to carry us along in the story, there are still these moments of utter surprise. And I wanted to just have you talk a little bit maybe on how you decided how to parcel out that information of the really weighty events that happened in Alex's past.
Yeah, figuring out how to deal with that exposition is always really interesting. Again, this exposition, it's always a trick of figuring out how much of the forward moving, you know, the forward moving narrative is always what keeps us on board. And then the exposition is the stuff that we need to know in order for it to really, for us to understand it, for it to fully resonate. And I think from the very beginning, figuring out how to, like, where to drop that in. Do you do it all, like, at the very front and then you don't have to deal with it anymore? I had this one professor, and I don't know how much I understood it at the time, but said that, I always remember him saying that ironically, the more that you have going on in the present of a story, the more weight of the past it can bear. So, like, if you just have somebody kind of sitting around in a room, ruminating, and then you kind of drift into the past, and then you, like, give us these huge chunks of, like, things that happened in the past, and then bring us back to the room, it's actually harder, according to this guy, than if, you know, everybody's standing on the hill about to charge into battle, and then as they're running down into the gunfire, you know, flip us into the past and, you know, kind of give us this memory of what has happened, and then you bring us back into the battle. So according to him, like, the more you had going on, the more weight it could bear. Mm-hmm. So did this give me a strategy? I don't know, but this story is somewhere in between. Like, no, there's no huge battle scenes. It's just like a step or two above kind of sitting in a room. It's kind of slow moving. They're like, go on this road trip. They drive along, they pass some garage sales, mm-hmm. they get to this kind of rural fair, and they wander around some more. So if I was thinking about it in that way, there's not any place where there's so much going on. Like, until you get to the, you know, maybe till the very end, it's a little reflective of Alex's psyche, because I think, to my mind, he's somebody who withholds, even mm-hmm. from himself. The death is something that's ever present, and that gets offered up early. But even the Down syndrome is kind of related to something that he feels ashamed about. So it's, to me, it's like a little reflective of, you know, he's kind of coming to terms with it. And so it kind of gets snuck in there. Like, we just mention it. Oh, you know, and after he was diagnosed, some stuff. Uh-huh. And then he, you know, but he acted badly. And so he thinks about it kind of sideways, like not straight on. And then, of course, the whole affair and the phone call, that's like the secret that he's holding on to. So for the whole time, I mean, like, the whole story, when you think about it, is just this story about whether he's actually going to come out with it or try to repair his marriage without ever having to give up this secret.
Right. And so do you think when that info is given out, it's given out in a very undramatic way? It's very sort of abrupt. It comes upon the reader, you know, we get a new paragraph and here's this big bombshell of information. Do you think that reflects Alex's psyche as well?
Yeah, absolutely. That he's kind of repressing his emotions and kind of compartmentalizing the experience. So he acknowledges these facts, but it's like he's trying not to engage with them too much. Mm-hmm. Until at the end, when it all comes out, to me, it's like something beyond his will. So he literally vomits out all this stuff that he's been, like, trying to push down inside. So especially in that last moment, I wanted it to feel like that, like almost mechanical, because it's what the body has to do in order to survive.
Uh-huh.
He's, you know, when you string things out a little bit, like in terms of making something dramatic, I guess you think of dramatic as having an element of hope or fear, like some kind of result. And mm-hmm. and that moment at the end for him is beyond hope or fear. He doesn't have any strategy or agenda. He's not thinking about how she's going to react. It's just this kind of necessity.
Literally vomiting up the information.
Yeah.
Going off our topic of craft and technique, but I was just very curious. The story seems so deeply rooted to me in the Midwest. Just this, you know, these two people, for her coming home, but for Alex being sort of transposed into this world that he really doesn't understand. He feels like an outsider. And I just wondered if that setting was inherent when you came up with the idea for the story, how the Midwest sort of played in to what you wanted to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think once I realized that this was the story and there was a time when the story was a little different, I'm from the Midwest, mm-hmm. I guess. And I always knew that the accident happened someplace where there were tall buildings.
Right.
And I've also spent some time in New York and, you know, just in terms of kind of trying to ground things. And maybe I live in Los Angeles now, which is also, we like to think we're a big city. And I feel like coming from the Midwest to a big city is in some ways easier than going back the other direction. I think maybe because cities are comprised of so many different kinds of people. But then when you meet people, especially kind of New Yorkers who, when they come to the Midwest, there is this kind of discomfort. So she's been somebody that he knew in this context of the city, but now he has to really kind of see her past, where she's from, and he's outside his comfort zone. And then there's just this one other element where we realize that she has this escape hatch. She has this option of coming back to this place that she belonged before all of the stuff with them ever happened. And it feels very apart. And it's something that he's been worrying about the entire time, too. It's that she seems to be getting over things. She seems to be moving on, that she's got this place. And he doesn't have that. Like, where everything happened is where he's from. And I don't think he feels that potential in himself to be someplace else. Mm-hmm. So he's got to figure out a way that he's going to live with it there where it happened.
I think it's so interesting how stories, when they're germinating, you sort of have a feel for where they need to be. So,
yeah.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Barrington. We really appreciated talking with you, and we loved working with Superman Falling. So we really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was really fun to kind of revisit this and talk with you guys.
You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast, which can be found on iTunes and at the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. To learn more about Barrington and her writing, visit barringtonsmith.net. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.